Welcome to the deep dive. You know, when you hear about labor strikes in the news, the focus is almost always on the picket line, right? Or the negotiations.
Yeah, that's what grabs the headlines.
But today, we're diving into something else. It's the really detailed, kind of behind the scenes planning, the stuff that happens months before a strike might even kick off.
And that planning is absolutely crucial. Strikes, well, they rarely just pop up out of nowhere. There's usually a long buildup, contract talks, tensions.
Right.
And for the people in charge, the executives, the strategists, they need to answer one core question. How do we keep the essential parts of the operation running?
Exactly. So that's our mission today. We want to understand how organizations take what feels like this, huge operational crisis
Yeah, potentially existential.
and turn it into something manageable, a logistical challenge, a financial one, sure, but manageable.
And the key is figuring out that functional floor. What's the absolute minimum number of people needed to keep things stable during a strike?
And why isn't that number just like fixed? Why is it always changing?
Well, because stable itself means different things once that strike hits. This isn't just about making a schedule. It's risk management. It's protecting revenue, reputation, making sure you're following the law, all under intense pressure.
Okay, let's unpack that then. Before you can even count heads, you need to define stabilization for your specific situation. It's clearly not business as usual, so where's the line?
Yeah, it varies massively. I mean, wildly. If you're a big retailer heading into the holidays, maybe stabilization means meeting, say, 60-70% of customer demand. You don't want empty shelves.
Makes sense.
But if you run a natural gas pipeline or a hospital, stabilization is completely different. It means keeping only the most critical safety functions going, the legally required stuff.
Our sources point to sort of three key benchmarks, these non-negotiable things that help set that minimum level, like operational guardrails.
Right. The first one's pretty obvious. Revenue continuity. You got to keep enough going, whether it's production or services, to avoid, well, a total financial meltdown during the strike.
If your plant loses $500,000 a day when it's idle, yeah, that adds up fast.
Exactly. Then number two is regulatory compliance. And this one, there's no wiggle room.
Right.
You absolutely have to make sure you're not breaking any safety laws, environmental rules, industry standards, just because your regular workforce isn't there.
Failing on that isn't just a slap on the wrist.
No, it can mean huge fines or even getting shut down long term. It's serious.
Okay, and the third benchmark.
This is the one executives often struggle to put a hard number on, but it keeps them up at night. Customer retention. You have to deliver just enough quality or just enough product to stop your customers from leaving for good. If a major client switches suppliers because you missed one critical shipment, that revenue might never come back, strike resolved or not.
Wow. Yeah. The context really changes everything. Think about a hospital. Stabilization there means having enough staff for the ICU, the ER, key
That's the
surgery.
death stuff.
Exactly. The minimum staff percentage is going to be high, maybe 70, 80% even.
Now, compare that to maybe a large manufacturing plant. Stabilization there could look like just running one single production line, maybe at 30% capacity.
Just enough to fill the most crucial orders.
Right. Focusing on the biggest contracts, letting the rest idle, the planning, the cost, the level of risk they're willing to take, totally different worlds.
So once you've defined what minimum success looks like, the next step is figuring out who you need. And it's not guesswork, right? It's a layered process.
Definitely layered. And you really have to start with the industry itself. You know, how complex is it? What's the risk tolerance? Regulations play a huge role here.
Okay, so like healthcare or emergency services.
The thresholds there are super rigid. Patient safety, legal rules, like nurse-to-patient ratios dictated by the state. There's just very little flexibility. You can't cut corners on safety or compliance.
Lives are on the line.
Precisely. And similarly, think about transportation or utilities.
Yeah.
Minimum staffing levels are often strictly set by federal agencies. The FAA telling you how many controllers you need, or federal rules about engineers for a power grid or a chemical plant. Non-negotiable.
Okay. But what about places with maybe a bit more flexibility, like manufacturing or warehousing? You can slow down production, right?
You can, yes. You can reduce the overall volume. But even then, you still need certain key people. You know, those specialized machine operators, the logistics folks making sure things move, and definitely safety officers. Those roles are essential, even at reduced capacity.
Which brings us beyond just the industry to the specific skills needed, because you can't just replace every striking worker with a temp, right?
Not at all. especially for the critical functions. Organizations really zero in on about four categories of essential roles.
Okay, what are they?
First, your mission-critical specialists. Think licensed operators, certified techs, maybe specialized nurses in a healthcare setting. People with unique, mandatory skills.
Got it. The irreplaceable ones.
Exactly. Second, supervisory staff. This is crucial because you need people to manage and coordinate the temporary workers who often walk in completely cold. They don't know the site, the procedures.
Right. Someone needs to onboard them, direct them.
Third, dedicated technical support, keeping the IT systems, the machinery, the infrastructure itself running. If that fails, everything stops.
And fourth.
And this sometimes gets overlooked in the rush. Safety critical and compliance officers, you need people whose job it is to constantly monitor, document, and ensure you're meeting every single legal and safety standard, even with a skeleton crew.
That tech support point you made, that leads into automation, doesn't it? That's a huge factor now.
Oh, absolutely. And it's fascinating, actually. Automation creates this interesting trade-off during a strike. On one hand, it can definitely lower the number of, you know, manual laborers you need.
Right. Maybe you can hit 60% output with only 40% of the usual staff because the machines do more.
Exactly. That's the potential upside. But, and this is a big but.
There's always a catch.
Automation drastically shifts your risk profile. You become incredibly reliant on a very small number of highly specialized, often highly paid engineers and IT folks.
The people who actually know the automated systems?
Precisely. If that complex system crashes at 3 a.m., you can't just call in any temp worker. You need the one engineer who understands the custom code running that multi-million dollar setup.
So your whole operation could grind to a halt because that key person is unavailable or on the picket line.
That's the risk. Your fancy automated plant becomes a very expensive paperweight. The minimum headcount number might drop, but the criticality and specialization of those remaining, it skyrockets.
It becomes less about filling shifts and more about securing a few very specific, very expensive brains.
It's a really delicate balance. And that's why companies don't just, you know, guess a number. They use intensive scenario modeling to figure out where that functional floor actually lies.
Okay, let's walk through that modeling. Maybe use an example, like a chemical plant, a continuous flow operation.
Good example. So first step, map critical functions. You identify every process that absolutely cannot stop without risking, well, a disaster, an explosion, an environmental leak. Things need constant monitoring.
Got it. The must-run systems.
Then step two, assign minimum roles to those specific functions. For that chemical process, you need certified control room operators, maybe field monitors checking for leaks, maintenance techs on call 24/7. You figure out the bare minimum crew to safely run just that critical equipment, maybe ignoring overall output for a moment.
Just safety and basic function first.
Right. And then the third step, which is non-negotiable, add compliance and safety layers. You take that bare minimum number and you bump it up to meet every single federal safety rule, every environmental reg, every state requirement.
Ah, so the final number incorporates all the legal mandates.
Exactly. That final risk-adjusted number, that's your functional floor. If you can't staff at least that many qualified people, you basically have to shut down. The risk of fines, or worse, is just too high.
Which leads right into the money side of things, the financial trade-off. Because staffing even that minimum floor, it's expensive.
Incredibly expensive.
So executives have to weigh that cost, the direct cost of bringing in contingency staff, against the potentially devastating cost of a full shutdown.
And the numbers are often huge on both sides. The direct costs. You're paying strike staffing agencies maybe 1.5 times, sometimes even 3 times the normal wage rate, plus travel, housing, security for those workers.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to factor in rush training time.
Getting people unfamiliar with the site up to speed safely.
Right. But then look at the indirect costs of shutdown. Lost revenue alone could be millions a week, but also losing customers permanently, facing contract penalties for missed deliveries. That damage can last for years, long after the strike ends.
So it's a tough calculation.
It is. But this is where a break-even analysis comes in. Let's say it costs, I don't know, $250,000 a week for that specialized contingent crew. Sounds enormous, right?
Yeah.
But if running that minimum operation prevents, say, $1.5 million or $3 million a week in lost revenue and contract penalties and potential long-term customer loss. Well, suddenly that $250,000 looks like necessary risk management.
It's expensive insurance, basically.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah.
And connecting this back to the bigger picture, this whole minimum headcount planning exercise, it's really about showing resilience. It lets leadership negotiate, knowing they can keep the core business stable. It sends a message to the market, to customers, that they're reliable, even under pressure.
It's not just about the immediate labor dispute.
Less about winning the negotiation today and more about preventing long-term damage to the brand. Proving your business can weather the storm.
Okay, so this is where it gets really interesting, I think. You've done all this internal calculation, but then you have to look at where your facility actually is. Because the state you operate in can totally change the calculation, right?
Oh, drastically. Geography, local labor laws, the political climate, they all impact how high that minimum headcount floor needs to be.
So give us some examples. How does it vary?
Okay, well, take Illinois. Generally known for strong labor protections, sometimes specific staffing ratio laws in certain industries like construction companies there, they often have to plan for higher stabilization levels, maybe closer to that 60-70% mark.
Because the scrutiny is higher.
Exactly. Regulatory scrutiny is intense, and unions are often well-organized to flag any safety concerns if staffing looks thin.
Okay, what about somewhere else, like Minnesota?
Minnesota's interesting. You've got a huge concentration of healthcare there, complex systems, highly organized labor. The political and media focus on patient care during any disruption is massive.
So understaffing a hospital during a strike, there would be?
A huge story. Intense regulatory heat, immediate bad press. So effectively, it forces non-negotiable, compliance-first staffing levels, especially for roles like nurses.
Right. Now contrast that with a state like Texas.
Texas operates as a right-to-work state. Generally, that gives employers more flexibility in using non-union contingency workers. So for some types of businesses, maybe general manufacturing or logistics, they might be able to stabilize at lower percentages, perhaps 30-40%.
But there's a limit even there, right?
Absolutely. Federal law trumps state flexibility when it comes to safety. If you're running an oil refinery in Texas or a major transportation hub, you are still 100% bound by strict OSHA rules, Department of Transportation mandates on licensing, minimum crew sizes, things like that.
So the state environment might give you some political breathing room, but federal safety rules are the hard backstop everywhere.
That's a good way to put it, especially in high-risk industries.
Okay, so quick takeaways for someone listening. Is there one single universal legal minimum headcount for a strike?
No, absolutely not. It's totally specific to federal rules. FAA, GOT, OSHA are big ones, and then state-level laws, especially around professional licenses like nursing ratios.
And generally speaking, across most industries, what's a typical stabilization percentage we see?
Well, the average or median seems to fall somewhere in that 30% to 60% range of normal staffing. But again, that average hides the variation.
Right. You got to remember the outliers.
Exactly. Yeah. Healthcare pushing much higher, maybe 70-80%. Some highly automated industrial sites potentially getting by closer to that 30-40% functional floor. It really depends.
So we've covered a lot of ground here, defining stabilization, the factors in the calculation, the modeling, the money, the geography. It seems the core idea is that this minimum headcount, it's really a strategic tool.
It is. It's defensive, yes, but also strategic. It lets leadership negotiate with more confidence because they know the lights can stay on, basically. And maybe more importantly, it shows reliability when everything seems chaotic.
Protecting the business under maximum pressure.
Which leads to maybe the final thought we want to leave you with today. The biggest mistake a company can make here, it probably isn't overpaying for temporary strike staff, even at 3 times the normal wage.
What is it then?
It's underestimating what that true minimum headcount needs to be. It's getting the calculation wrong and then triggering a major safety incident or a regulatory violation or losing your biggest customers forever. That kind of failure. The cost is astronomical, far beyond whatever premium labor might have cost.
So the whole process really forces a hard look at a fundamental question. What's the real, often hidden cost of just keeping things viable in your specific industry? And how much does that cost change when you factor in the ethical weight the safety mandates?
That's the question. Something to think about until our next deep dive.